Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
Boys, I'm mellow as a honeydew. Yeah.
That cat is high. Look that look in his eye. Oh man, he's high. Yes, higher than a kite.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. Today in the studio, this is the third time that we've had Frank Cisneros in the studio at the Speakeasy. Welcome back.
What's up, guys? Thanks. It's great to be on.
You are a very, very busy dude, as always.
And likewise.
Yeah, totally. But now you're even busier. Today we're going to talk about your newest outpost, the Bourgeois Pig in Brooklyn, in Carroll Gardens.
That's right.
Not far from where we used to
attend the bar together.
Yeah. And, I mean, we might as well just jump right into this. Jesus, you've got the drink. You're still working at Dram. Now the Bourgeois Pig.
Yeah.
And a little bit about the Bourgeois Pig in the city. It's been around for quite some time.
Yeah, I think seven plus years, almost 8 years.
It's in the opening credits of Saturday Night Live.
I just found that out.
And the thing about the Bourgeois Pig is that it's definitely like a cocktail bar and restaurant, but it's only beer and wine. There's no spirits.
Yeah, exactly. What happened was when they started it, my partner Ravi is his first bar. It actually started out as kind of being like a coffee shop. Mm-hmm. And then they started doing coffee cocktails. This is like 8 years ago. So it was like crazy stuff for back then.
Yeah.
And then they started doing beer and wine, but they could only get a beer and wine license since they're like immediately next to a church. So having a full-on like spirits license wasn't really in the cards for them. So then they started to experiment a lot, and some really, really amazing bartenders have been through there. Katie Stipe and Phil Ward did the original program there, so they're, you know, obviously extremely talented people. So when I started working with Ravi, in the meantime, while we've been waiting for the Bourgeois Pig Brooklyn to open, I went over there to do their fall-winter cocktail menu, completely revamped. It had been quite a while since anyone had paid attention to the menu, and it was extremely challenging because it's beer and wine only. I mean, you and I come from like this like cocktail background. Where
super boozy.
Yeah, super boozy. I mean, that's what we know. We know like spiritus cocktails, so not being able to rely on the proof of, you know, 40% alcohol or more was really, really challenging, but really enlightening too.
So, with that being said, I mean, you're using what you can legally use. I mean, you've got obviously wine and beer, but then you have like vermouth, sherry and port and Madeira, different kinds of things. Like, obviously, there's certain other spirits that can be involved,
exactly.
Like
it's
Aperol.
It's really funny and really tricky. I mean, in New York State, the law says that you can use anything that has a wine base up to a certain percentage. So it's really interesting. The first thing I did is kind of like an artist sets out like his palette of all your different paints. I researched everything I could use. It's like, okay, all right, this is what I've got. What can I make out of this? Like knowing that I don't have rum, I don't have whiskey, I don't have gin. I can't use the stuff that we're like used to using. So, yeah, sherry became indispensable, especially Fino sherry, because Fino sherry has relatively high proof with like a relatively strong alcohol flavor and then also being relatively neutral. So you can, that functions as a nice base to be able to add other things to. But it's really funny because you can use something like Zuka and Cardamaro are allowable, but Chinar is not, even though Chinar is 16%.
Right, right.
Because there's no wine base. It's like, it's really convoluted and doesn't make a whole lot of sense as to how it works. But what wound up happening, we made 32 cocktails for it. My partner, Seth Tabor, helped me on that. He's an old friend of mine. You know Seth.
Yeah. John Dory. I've got some pictures of you guys together from Tales of the Cocktail.
Yeah, yeah. They should be destroyed.
Well, I'm working on that. My iPhone is completely cracked up right now. So
good.
We're almost there. You're almost safe.
Thank God. So, yeah, we wound up making 32 cocktails for the list, and it turned out probably about 24 of them or so have some form of sherry in it or some sherry or another. One of the really cool things that we tried to do was one of the things that we realized is proof is so important in cocktails. We all know that. You know, there's the aspects of cocktails we all know are important, like, you know, the flavors, obviously.
Yeah.
But there's the things that people forget about, like the water content, the temperature,
the dilution,
the proof. All these things are so important to a cocktail, and you forget how important they are until that stuff gets taken away from you. And you realize you can over-dilute things really, really quickly. So one thing that we wound up doing is we wanted to make something dark and stormy-esque. So we used like a Pedro Ximenez sherry, ginger syrup, lime. And we realized you can't just add soda water to a sherry-based cocktail. A lot of times it just becomes overly diluted, flabby, it just washes out entirely. So in order to carbonate it, we charge the whole cocktail. We put it in a soda siphon, charge the entire thing.
That's interesting. There's a lot of there was a little bit in Bon Appetit very recently about it was actually at the PDT cocktail book release party. They were talking about they went around and asked a lot of the bartenders like what they're into and what they're like over and.
Carbonated cocktails.
Carbonated cocktails thing, came up a lot. I said I was going to start using mud, but maybe I'd had too many drinks that night. But I think carbonating anything, especially like with your vermouths, especially something like pretty
cool.
Rich and thick, like your like Carpano Antica, that kind of stuff. It's a really interesting dip, and that was a great idea on your part. Are you finding that like I know like back in the day. You and I used to come up with different like descriptors for like spirits or wine, and and your whole thing was using the different settings on a synthesizer. So one of those being the attack,
an oscillation.
Yeah. So one of them was being the attack, and I use that term a lot with cocktails. You know, and obviously the attack would be more of like your proof and your spice. So
it's
you're
true. Yeah. That's the thing that hits you first.
You're trying to like. Create with what you have that has little attack, little proof, and make that happen. What are some of the ways that you've done this? I mean, obviously, you just said you did ginger, you did like a darker stormy, which obviously has some attack to it.
Then
carbonating, but what were some of the other ways?
One of the things that we found out when you're working with wine or beer cocktails is to dial back the sugar, which is tough to do in some ways because I think sugar to a bartender is like salt to a chef. And just like home cooks always make the mistake of not salting their dishes enough, I think home bartenders often, you know, the whole not too sweet thing. Everyone is really afraid of things being too sweet, and I totally get that. But sugar,
we're going to have to talk about that.
Yeah, that's
in a little bit.
That's a whole thing. But I mean, sugar. You have to remember that sugar acts as a flavor enhancer, so it takes the other flavors that are inherent in whatever you've got, like be it ginger or mint or whatever, and it drives them forward. It expresses them. Further on someone's palate. So it's an essential ingredient. But also what winds up happening is when you're working with things like sherries and you're working with things that don't have a lot of proof, any amount of sugar will tend to mask that, what little proof it does have, so you have to dial it back. So instead, we rely on the sweetness inherent in the sherry or the sweetness inherent in the vermouth. We let that kind of speak and then give it something else. Like I'm used to making like a 2-to-1 ginger syrup, for instance. May not work in every single wine and beer cocktail circumstance. Mm-hmm. Might do a 101 or something like that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, and what, you know, a lot of people don't realize, or maybe they do, is, you know, sugar is essential for any alcohol. You know, it's like...
Yeah, it's part of it.
It's part of it. That's what it is. It, like, you throw some yeast in there, and then it converts the sugars to alcohol. That's what it is. But with like you're saying, with like wines, sherries, you've got more residual sugar.
Yeah, than more than a spirit. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
And so you have to rely on that inherently more so than you wouldn't with a cocktail.
Yeah. So some of the I want to talk about the sweetness in cocktails and people saying not too sweet.
God, I got to ask you a question. How many times a night do you hear that? Like when someone's like, "Can I get this, but like not too sweet?"
Not too sweet.
Quite a bit. Can I get a bartender's choice with vodka? Not too sweet.
It's like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
Vodka rocks.
30 times a night, at least.
Yeah, sure. But I mean, like, do you think that that's because it's the customer's palate that is actually, like, the customer being into something that is drier? Or if it's because of the fact that so many bars for, you know, even in our lifetimes, you know, it's like going in bars. But yeah. It's always like all these drinks, they always come out so sweet because that's just like old school. Like that's a product of like post-prohibition.
Exactly. Like, I think it's 100% the latter. It's a product of post-World War II America, like consumerism. Like everything came out of a gun. Everything was margarita mix or sour mix. It was just predetermined sweetness. And of course, all of us have experienced that. Like the vast majority of bars out there make drinks that are too sweet. So it's absolutely okay. I mean, it's not okay, but it makes sense where that comes from. But it's the same thing as going into a restaurant and you wouldn't say like, you know, can I get the spatzel, but like not too salty.
Sure.
Like you're going to trust that the chef is salting it appropriately.
Exactly.
Like every drink that we make is going to have the appropriate sweetness. We would like to think that we don't put anything that's too much of anything, let alone sweet.
Which brings me to my question for you now. When people say not too sweet, do you alter your recipe or do you just make it the way you normally do?
I make it the way I normally do.
Exactly.
Especially if it's either a classic cocktail or a cocktail that's on our menu, it's been calibrated to not be too much of anything, not too acidic, not too sweet, not too spicy, not too bitter. It's already not too of anything. It's balanced, so I'm not going to touch it.
Exactly. Let's talk about this real quick, too. I mean, especially with a 32 wine and beer focused cocktail menu at the new...
The old Bourgeois Pig new menu. Yeah,
new menu at the old Bourgeois Pig. It's like, I don't think also that a lot of people realize that for all those cocktails to be on that menu, there's a process that's involved. It's not like you just came up with a bunch of ideas, printed them up, and put them on the bar. Yeah, exactly. There's a whole process. You get your bartenders together, they submit their cocktail ideas.
Yeah.
Then that goes through another round of submittal. Like, you have to taste through them, alter them. There's a lot that goes on before a recipe hits the menu.
With that particular menu, actually, we did all of them ourselves. So there was no submissions from other bartenders. It was completely just Seth and myself. And what we wound up doing was, like I said, first step was figure out the palette. Like, figure out, like, what can we use? Like, what are our paints that are available to us?
Yeah.
So laid all those out. We bought, like, one of everything, basically. And we set up a test bar, like a test kitchen in Jane Sweet Buns, like my girlfriend's bakery, which isn't really a bar, but, like, we just brought in everything. We brought in jiggers, glassware, ice, juices, syrups, all the different vermouths and sherries and wines and beers that we had available to us, and we just went to town. But it took a long, long time. I think one thing I like to always tell people is that a great cocktail is the process of 50 bad ones. Like, it's 50 failures make one good one. Like, you try it and you're like,
maybe
okay.
For you, dude. Yeah. I nail it every time.
Yeah, every time, first time. I mean, I think with the first one, we always get it close. We're always like, okay, cool. This is in the right direction. From the first drink that we make, we can go like, okay, this has potential, or this is absolutely doesn't have potential. Let's skip and go to something else. So if it has potential, then it becomes like this perpetual dichotomy, this split and split and split and split. Like, okay, let's try it this way. Let's do it with half an ounce. Let's do it with a quarter ounce. Let's add a dash of absinthe.
Quarter teaspoon.
Yeah,
as opposed to a bar spoon.
You keep going like over and over and over until you find like just the perfect balance. Which again goes back to the not too sweet thing. If we went through that much process for one, I can guarantee you that it's not too sweet.
Yeah, exactly. So let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, I want to talk about some more of the, I want to get into like some of the like syrups and different spices and stuff that you use to like as far as modifiers go for these cocktails.
Yeah.
And then we're going to talk about
the new
bar.
Sweet.
All right. We'll be right back.
Went to a party. I danced all night. I
And we are back. We've been speaking with Frank Cisneros of The Drink and the new Bourgeois Pig in Brooklyn. Yeah. We've been talking about wine and beer cocktails. Now we're going to move right into the new place, and I want to talk about a little bit. But before we do, let's talk about like some of the different like syrups and the process of modifying and pairing some of these different spices and creating that attack.
Absolutely.
Like, what were some of your ideas for the?
So you were talking about spice, essential element, especially when you're relying on less proof. And when I say spice, I don't mean like habanero spice. You know, we're talking like cinnamon, allspice, tea spices.
Sure.
And so going into tea, we relied a lot on tea syrups. Easiest thing in the world to make. Everyone always thinks they're like really difficult, but like it's the best thing ever. One of the drinks that actually carried over to the new menu. At the new Bourgeois Pig, it's the only drink that we carried over from the old Bourgeois Pig is called the Fleur de Florence, and it uses what's called a Florence tea syrup, which is a proprietary tea blend, I suppose. It winds up tasting kind of like hazelnut and cocoa, but has like really nice fall winter sort of spice element, and we just wound up doing a somewhat simple champagne cocktail with it, and we used black walnut bitters, which adds this kind of like maple and walnut
the
note
Fee Brothers?
To it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's super maple heavy.
Super maple heavy, yeah. And so then that combined with sparkling wine, I always said that like what it winds up doing is makes like halfway decent sparkling wine taste like awesome champagne when you put everything together. It winds up having all like the notes that you expect from a vintage champagne.
Oh yeah, so it's got like some of that nuttiness and like a grower champagne.
Yeah, cool. It's like grower champagne. It's absolutely awesome. So we would do things like that. We wound up using all sorts of tea syrups. We had autumnal cranberry tea syrup, what else? Earl Grey, of course. We wound up doing a lot of infusions where we would do like hibiscus tea infused Lillet. Because you can't add too many other modifying things other than maybe a syrup and a citrus element, you don't want to dilute what little proof you do have. So we wound up infusing a lot of things. Like we do a Lapsang Souchong infused Amontillado sherry. So Amontillado sherry is, of course, like a drier style of sherry, but aged somewhat. So it has those oxidized notes and the nuttiness. When we infused it with the Lapsang Souchong, it winds up being sort of Scotch-like. So we did that with a vermouth, and it winds up being sort of like a Rob Roy, but like it's really interesting.
That's very cool.
Lower proof Rob Roy, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
One of my favorite tea pairings is cinnamon and rooibos tea, man. It's one of the best, man.
We wound up, of course, like being fall winter appropriate, a lot of cinnamon syrups,
of course.
Cinnamon bark syrups and stuff like that.
And like clove and like all we like did the it, winter
yeah,
spice.
We wound up making kind of our own velvet for Lernum by doing like a cinnamon allspice.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. So you were saying that one of those carried on over to the new menu. What's the, I mean, now moving on to the new bar, you've got a full liquor license, so obviously you're going to be
rocking it out.
You're going to be rocking it out pretty like hardcore with the cocktails.
Yeah,
and it's in Carroll Gardens on Court Street.
Yeah. So a couple of things about the new menu. When Ravi approached me and said, "Hey, are you interested in coming on, becoming a partner in this bar?" And I was like, "Yeah, that sounds really cool." He's like, "We're going to have a full liquor license, unlike the old one. What do you think you'd want to do?" And I said, well, you know, the old one is all French. It's all French wine, beer, spirit. Yeah, totally. All French wine and beer. So I was like, well, if we're expanding just beyond wine, why don't we expand beyond France? But I kind of like working within some sort of limits. So I was like, why don't we do Europe?
Of course, after like working with like just beer and wine, it's like you're used to working with limits.
Yeah, it teaches you to like work within, to get creative. Like, yeah, you'd be surprised how creative you can get within like...
I did the tiki night with Brian Miller on Monday, and our sponsor was Famous Grouse. So we did a lot of Scotch tiki drinks and
the Grass Kilt.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of my favorite drinks. Yeah. But yeah, working in those limitations, it's like...
It's cool.
You can really come out with some
forces
cool
you to get like creative.
Absolutely.
So I was like, yeah, why don't we do Europe? Let's focus on the kind of underutilized spirits of continental Europe. And then that kind of birthed another cool little thing within that. And I was like, easiest way to describe it is this new concept is, imagine tiki. We're talking about tiki, right? So tiki in earnest starts in the 1930s, but it really gets going in post-World War II America.
Sure.
And, you know, that's when it had its, like, its real heyday. And it was equal parts, like, you know, escapism and, like, faux Polynesia exotica.
Sure.
And it was kind of harkening back in some ways to, like, the time that the GI spent during the war, like, in the South Pacific. Mm-hmm. Not that they were really sipping Mai Tais in the South Pacific when sure they were at war, but, like, there was still that, like, that exposure to that exoticness. At the same time, though, those GIs were also being exposed to the exotic by, relative to Middle America, exotic locales of the Mediterranean, like Italy, Normandy, France, and, you know, all of continental Europe during the war. So I thought, okay, let's go back and let's imagine, if you will, that tiki wasn't about the exotica of the South Pacific. It was about the exotica of the Mediterranean. What ingredients would you then use? So I came up with this kind of like Mediterranean tiki concept as a part of it. And that's going to be a small part of the menu. I've got three or four drinks, like an Amaro zombie. I've got a Spanish Mai Tai using like Cardinal Mendoza and Italian aquavite and hazelnut syrup. So it's kind of like taking the same ingredients, but then reimagining them a different way. And then carrying over what we learned from working with wine and beer. One of the drinks, for instance, that I worked on with Jonathan Armstrong from the Franklin in Philadelphia. He's going to be working with us 2 days a week at the new bar.
Great.
Awesome, dude. So we came up with this drink. It's three different cherries that you stir with two different vermouths. That yields 2 ounces. You take those 2 ounces, then you put it in your shaker tin, do 3/4 ounce of lime, 1/2 ounce of simple. So you have like a triple sherry-based daiquiri, essentially.
Oh, wow.
But you stir the sherries together, the sherries and the vermouths first. So what you end up with is like a kind of low proof daiquiri, and it's with an egg white. So it's like a low proof but heavy body daiquiri. So it's light and it's totally crazy. And that's in a way hearkening to what tiki does with splitting like 3-rum bases.
Yeah, of course.
So it's kind of like, you know, taking these like Mediterranean ingredients like sherries and vermouths and seeing what we could do with them in a tiki sort of format.
That's really cool. So. That's I don't want to make that drink. Yeah, I want to drink it, but I don't want to.
Bartender's gonna hate
me. I don't want to guest bartend there.
Yeah. Oh, you will. It's too bad.
Oh, sorry. but that's really cool. And you mentioned Normandy. So are you gonna do any kind of like Calvados?
Yeah, absolutely. We have. I wrote this whole primer. It's extremely irreverent. You know me. I swear a lot. So our whole bar manual is just
true.
full of swear words and veiled accusations. yeah, there's this whole section on brandies because it's really interesting. I think even bartenders, even fairly good bartenders, we think of brandy and we go cognac and Armagnac. Even if we touch Armagnac, you know, that's like as far as we go. But there's a whole world of brandies and brandy-based things out there.
Eau de vie,
exactly.
So many cool things. Like, so, I personally love using all of them.
Man. Me too. Just to list off some of the things that are on our menu, we've got Calvados, Armagnac, Cognac, Ratafia de Bourgogne, Pommeau, Pinot de Charente.
Pinot de Charente, that's killer.
Brandy de Jerez, Asbach Uralt, Aquavite de Uva, which is similar to Grappa, but it's made from actual grapes. So, I mean, we've got the whole gamut of anything. Yeah, Ue, exactly. Yeah. Anything that has any sort of like brandy base. And you realize that there's a whole world of brandies out there, and they're all so different. And there's also, it's almost like mother sauces in France, where like Ratafia de Bourgogne is basically like the same thing as Pommeau, which is basically the same thing as Pinot de Charente. It's just like they all do it in a different way. Yeah. It's like they do it with apples, but then they add some apple juice to the brandy. Or we do it from Burgundy grapes, and then we add some like Burgundy wine, and we add some Marc de Bourgogne to that.
Yeah.
Marc is another one that we've got on there too. So it's cool. I mean, It's gonna be interesting because there's all these wild ingredients from all over Europe, very brandy heavy, very like, you know, ingredients that people haven't seen a lot of, like Gilka. I've got a cut like a swizzle with Gilka on it, with Gilka in it. I've got
Kummel.
Kummel Gilka. I've got a cocktail with Palinkovic in it, which is a Croatian liqueur.
Yeah.
So trying to explore all these other European ingredients. But I'm also splitting the bases. So like, you know, our drink with Batavia Rack also has Buffalo Trace bourbon in it. So it's like, you know, the last thing I want to do is alienate anybody, because it's still like a neighborhood bar. You'll still be able to get a shot. You'll still be able to get a beer. But if you want to explore some cool different things that haven't been done out there too much,
I think that's totally okay. You know, I mean, like,
it's a cool neighborhood. I mean, you worked in Carroll Gardens for 4 years now.
Absolutely, man. And but I think with like not only just that neighborhood, but the city in general, it's like people want to learn more about it, and that's what we do. We're here to like educate and entertain, you know, and like I think that's really cool that you're using all these rare ingredients. That's totally up my alley, man. Yeah. Like first thing I do when I look at any cocktail list is I look around for the weird oddball ingredients stuff, yeah. Like or something I never heard of, and that's the first drink I order, you know.
Well, I mean, you're a big inspiration in that. Like, you know, the 2 years or so I spent working with you, like I learned a lot about these different spirits. You haven't worked at Linnell's. Like, you taught me more about spirits. It's pretty much you and Nick Jarrett are like the top spirits, like knowledge wise out there. So yeah, I mean, huge inspiration there.
Well, thanks, man. Hey, speaking of the neighborhood.
Yeah.
I know that there's we've got a couple minutes left here. There was something that you were telling me. Is this still going to happen as far as like the late night thing?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about it? Like, especially the bartenders that listen to the show are going to love this.
Absolutely. So there's no secret. I love my fellow bartenders. I wanted to do something cool. You know, in that neighborhood, we've got a bunch of really great bartenders that live there. You know, you've got Joaquin Simo, Phil Ward lives over there.
Brian Miller.
Yeah. Damon Bolte. Damon Dyer.
Damon Dyer's in there?
Yeah. So, you know, a bunch of cool people. And then there's just a huge amount of absolutely amazing bars. You've got Prime Meats, Clover Club, you know, Brooklyn Social, Henry Public. All kinds of great bars, great bartenders all around, even like not cocktail bars, all kinds of cool people work and live down there.
Yeah, Nick Coles.
Yeah, Nick is awesome. What's up, Nick? You guys awesome.
Yeah, what's up, Nick?
So,
of course, Nick is like single-handedly like turning Mini Bar into a cocktail joint.
Which is, yeah, totally I've noticed cool. That over the past few years. So, you know, one thing that I always remember, we'd get off from Prime Meats and we'd try to go to like Abilene's or something or Bar Great Harry, and half the time they'd close at like 1 or 2 or something, which is cool.
Because they were slow.
They're slow or whatever. So we're going to be open until 4 a.m. every single night from 2 to 4 at least, if not 1 to 4. We're going to have a late night menu, so we've got food going till 4. And we're going to do a Fernet Branca bottle service.
That's awesome.
So it's going to be...
I love that.
Yeah. It's going to be 375s of Fernet Branca. So like the little half bottle, you get about 16-ish small shots out of it, which is a pretty good amount. So you roll in with like four of your dudes afterwards.
What are you going to drink?
Yeah, right? You're just going to put a straw in it. So you come in, you get your little mini bottle of Fernet Branca, 4 Pilsners, and it's like $35.
I seem to recall a night when I was hanging out with Julian Brizzi from Rucola.
Yeah.
And what's up, Julian?
Got married.
He just got married. Congratulations to him. He had brought back. He brought back 2 375s of Fernet Branca from Argentina, and we were hanging out in his apartment, drinking them out of the bottle with koozies on them.
That's awesome.
He'd had them in the
like
freezer.
A beer.
Yeah, like a beer.
And so the other thing too is I'm working on a Campari 375s, which should be coming at the end of the year.
Nice.
And the Campari will come out with a little soda. So you got like, you know, your Campari and soda bottle service.
Chartreuse also comes in 375s.
Indeed. Putting away an entire bottle of, although I did that once, I drank an entire pint of yellow chartreuse out of the bottle. But yeah, maybe we'll do that too.
We'll see what happens. Man, it sounds awesome. And like everything that you've talked about today on the show today has been really great. I can't wait for my first opportunity to get to go hang out. Actually, we're going there tonight.
We're
going to
go there now,
man. Let's go there now.
Yeah, let's go there now. Why not? I got some glassware with me. Let's hang out.
Let's do it.
All
let's
right.
go hang out at the Bourgeois Pig in Brooklyn. What's the address?
387 Court Street. It's at Court and First Place.
Court and First Place.
Yeah.
Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn.
Indeed.
Killer. And also visit Frank's other bar, The Drink.
The Drink, which is at 228 Manhattan. Tons of fun.
And you're still at Dram.
Still at Dram every Friday and Saturday. Thursday, Friday, Saturday this week. So
I can't believe you even made it on the show today. I'm very appreciative of that. Well, thanks again for coming on the show. It's been great to have you.
It's my pleasure, man. Thank you.
And we'll be heading over there right now. And tune in next week. We'll have Nate DeMoss and Alan Katz from the New York Distilling Company in the Shanty. Until then, cheers.
Oh, man, cheers. High. Yes, higher than a kite. Baba Doody.
That cat is high.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. Yes, he's high. Man, he's higher than a guy. This is a message from Sea to Table. Can the fish come back to South Street? On December 18th, the New Amsterdam Market will pay homage to the Old Fulton Fish Market by including a special section dedicated to the fisheries of the Northeast and New England with Sea to Table. Sea to Table partners with fishermen in the recovering fisheries of the Northeast. Their transparent model, delivering fish direct from docks to chefs across America, supports the traditional fisheries that are crucial to the survival of our working waterfronts. For the first time, Sea to Table will join the market to offer fresh fish direct from independent Northeast fishermen. The collaboration of Sea to Table with New Amsterdam will take us back in time for a day to the era when fishmongers dominated Lower Manhattan. So stop by the New Amsterdam Market at Peck Slip and South Street in Manhattan on December 18th and support your local fishermen and fisheries. For more information on Sea to Table, visit www.seatotable.com. That's C, S-E-A, the number 2, table.com.